waiting for us, girl. It ran one step ahead as we followed in the dance. Between the parted pages, and we're pressed in love's hot fevered iron like a striped pair of pants. MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again. Oh no.
Hello everybody.
Welcome to the film room.
We are back on another Patreon episode. Back on another episode from my bloodline.
From your mother this time.
Yes, my mother.
She requested a Richard Harris film, A Man Called Horace.
Yeah, this is a film that probably would not have been on our radar except for my mother requesting it. And that's kind of what we love about doing these Patreon episodes, is they let us put movies on the radar that we wouldn't have normally gotten to do. We wouldn't have done last week's episode without it.
Oh yeah, that's for certain.
That's for certain. And I'm glad we did. And we wouldn't have done this one. And this one, well, I'm going to be blunt, we had a very different outcome on this one. This is a very different film that we're doing. We're covering a film that is, I don't know, I wouldn't say this is an unremembered film, actually. This is one that's pretty well liked within the Western circle. And that's what's kind of interesting about this. This is our first time to do a Western.
First, but not last.
It's our first, but not last. We have one coming up on the schedule. This is actually the first of two episodes in a row that of movies that were made long before I was born. So that's fun, too.
Yeah.
As I said, we're covering a Richard Harris film. And my mother is a huge Richard Harris fan. Hence the opening music that you heard coming in, because we had to. So, Mom, You picked a good one, because this was one that she had just seen recently, again.
Oh, nice. Yeah, hats off.
Yeah, so that's how we came to do this one, and let's jump in by discussing Harris a bit, because Harris is a figure who, to our generation, is known for one role, and, well, maybe two roles, but one role mostly. And that role is that of Dumbledore in the first two Harry Potter movies.
I'm sure this isn't entirely true, but I don't remember seeing him in anything outside of Harry Potter.
Gladiator.
Oh, well, there you go. Okay.
But he's only in Gladiator for like 15 minutes before he gets killed off.
Who does he play? I haven't seen Gladiator for years.
He plays the Emperor.
Okay, yeah. All right.
And then Joaquin Phoenix offs him.
Right.
He was a legendary figure in his day. But he has kind of slipped off the radar in terms of how well people know him today. But, you know, let's get back to Harry Potter, because, again, that is probably the role that people either know him from Gladiator or for Harry Potter. He was the first Dumbledore. He shot the first two films, although, I'll be honest, there's a healthy amount of the second film where I can tell that they were probably using stand-ins.
He died while they were shooting it?
No, he died after. He died but he was not in good health, and that's obvious.
Right.
Harris was very good in the first one. He was very much the character as we picture him.
Yeah.
But he was definitely not in good shape. You couldn't overlook the fact that he wasn't a man in good shape. And
I think a lot of people prefer his version over the
Michael Gambon.
Michael Gambon, yeah, I think. Just for the sake of one line, which is the Goblet of Fire.
Yeah.
That line, yeah.
Yeah, I like Gambon. I thought he did a really great job. Yeah. But
he did his own interpretation, which I did like, yes.
And that was what was nice, was he didn't try to do the same. But Harris was very good in the first one. True story, this is why I actually... I'm sorry, Mom, you requested this cast. You're going to get to hear this story. This is how I actually got to see the first Harry Potter movie on day one, was because my mom... got us tickets to see it that day.
Oh, nice.
And it was awesome. We're going to go through Potter at some point. That's one that we will definitely get to down the road. We're both big fans. We're both huge fans. And but again, Harris died between... his last major film that was released was Chamber of Secrets. But in his day, let's discuss alcohol, because Harris was one of the legendary... He was up there with Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole in terms of, you know, legendary cinematic figures, legendary cinematic drunks and partiers. And, I mean, he was a wild man in his day, and he was known for telling stories. He was a very popular guest on shows like The Tonight Show and Letterman. He was a regular fixture because he was an entertaining storyteller. When he did the first Harry Potter movie, he did go on Letterman and, you know, proved just as sharp as ever. So,
wow.
Yeah. There are a couple of books out about that era of Hollywood, and I've heard they're quite good. I haven't yet gotten to read them because I'm sorry, I don't have time to read everything. But
yeah,
Harris was a legendary figure. And, of course, one of the other movies that he's best known for is Camelot. He became a very rich man touring with Camelot. When his film career kind of cooled a little bit, that was how he kept his money up, was he toured with it. He did it, and I believe our requester did go see him in it at one point.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I think it's awesome. Harris is also, you know, he did a couple of albums, and did most notably record the song MacArthur Park.
Yeah, which I didn't connect that until you connected it for me.
As I said, Harris is an interesting figure, and he's definitely one well worth looking up. And so it makes sense that my mother would have us do one of his movies. Let's get on to this movie, because I actually have a lot to say about it.
We probably have to get the huge disclaimer out of the way.
Yeah, let's get the huge disclaimer out of the way, because I really don't want to talk about that too much on this cast.
Yeah.
How do we put this? This movie was made 45 years ago.
Yeah, it's not, as you say, all that politically correct by modern standards.
No. Native American activists openly hate the film.
And this is our, to be clear, this is our Whoopi Goldberg at the beginning, except we're not Native American, our Whoopi Goldberg at the beginning of Volume 3 of the Looney Tunes collection saying, hey, some of these cartoons aren't cool today, but we have to preserve them, blah blah blah.
Let's get the big things out of the way that do need to be addressed.
Yeah,
the film was not made by anybody in the Native American community. Very few of the speaking roles, if any, went to Native American actors. Most of the actors were, let's see, one was Fiji, one was from Greece, one was Quebec, one was from Quebec.
One thing I do have to ask, did they do any, like, I don't know how else to say it, but blackfacing of any of the actors for this?
Because they used Greek and Fijian actors, and I'm not sure, but I'm almost certain, probably, at least for the actress that played the mother.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but I'm almost certain, almost certainly. And they definitely cast people who were tan, but not Native Americans.
Yeah, unfortunately.
This is a movie that definitely, by the modern standards, would incite no end of protests because of decisions like this.
It's also what we call cultural appropriation.
It is cultural appropriation as hard as it can get. It is a movie about a white man who goes into the Sioux and winds up becoming the best of them. This is a plot that should not be able to be done today, but by God, sure still is.
Yeah, Avatar. Sorry, Avatar.
This movie is Avatar. It is Dances with Wolves. I actually happen to think Avatar is pretty damn great still, okay? But you know what? Let's call it what it is. Avatar did a better job of casting Native American actors than this movie, and it didn't even have Native American characters. It had obvious allegories for Native American characters, but it did a better job of casting people of color.
It did, yeah.
Because Wes Studi, the Native American actor, played the chief in it. So
really nice,
you know. But let's get all this out of the way and say this was there. And you know what? I'm going to kind of give the film a pass on this.
Yeah.
It was 1970. We are using the standards of 2015.
2015, yeah.
This is a movie not far removed from the golden age of the Western.
This is almost 50 years ago.
This is almost 50 years ago. So no, we're not actually going to hold the movie to these standards. We're going to acknowledge that they are out there, but we're also going to remember it was 1970. This is not a modern film. If they tried to pull this today, that'd be one thing. I mean, because come on, the idea of trying to depict a group, a very serious underrepresented group, and not casting those people in lead roles, come on, you could never get away with that today. What we're trying to say is, we are acknowledging that the movie is 45 years old, and we're trying to look at it in that lens.
And hey, it's a lot better than 2015 and Adam Sandler pulling the shit he did in his film.
Yeah, this movie, at least they tried. That's kind of how I feel about this movie, is in terms of handling the Native American material, at least they tried.
Yeah.
I think they tried very well, actually.
They did research. It states at the beginning of the film that, yeah, they put a lot of research into it.
They do depict the tribe very well. They do show a lot of respect, which, again, in this age, it's fair for its time. I don't blame the activists for disliking this film. I don't blame them for their frustration, and I think they're certainly from their perspective, I definitely understand.
Yeah, and they're not wrong.
They're not wrong. We're not ignoring that. But we do have to deal with this movie as a film. And as a film, this is actually really...
It's well done.
This is a really entertaining film. A little bit of backstory on the film. It's based on an episode of Wagon Train, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's based on a story that a woman wrote. And then that was adapted into an episode of Wagon Train. And the film was produced by CBS's theatrical unit, Cinema Center Films.
This is another one, like just like the last time, where I recognized the logo of the distributor. It's they released a lot of the Peanuts films. Well, pretty much all the Peanuts films.
Yeah, that's what they were. I mean, it was very much kind of their idea. The idea of the company was to release films that were similar to the kind of things they would show on TV. Sort of, because this movie was rated R and would have gotten an R rating today easily.
Fun fact, my dad just said, like, he's watching it right now. It's so if you hear any noises in the background, that's a man called Horse playing.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, he said that he actually saw it with his parents at a drive-in.
Which would have been a great place to see it. It's the kind of movie that basically CBS was doing. Most of the people that worked on it were TV. The director, Elliot Silverstein, was a TV, mostly director. The writer, I think most of the guy that wrote the actual screenplay, did some film and some TV. But yeah, this was definitely kind of an attempt at doing something that could eventually be edited for TV and shown there.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of has that feel, but in a good way. I mean, they were playing to the audience that they knew, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. So yeah, this was distributed. Paramount holds most of the distribution for these films today. It was a Paramount DVD that I watched this on.
It's got some graphic sequences in it.
It has some very graphic violence in it. No question about that. The makeup effects were done by the legendary John Chambers, the makeup artist behind such works as Planet of the Apes, and... boy, do they show. Chambers was a legend in the field, and he even got a cinematic portrayal recently in Argo.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, John Goodman played the part in Argo.
Really?
Yeah, and I can think of few higher honors than having John Goodman play your role.
That's really cool. And now that you mention it, I do think they did mention that some of his Planet of the Apes work in that film.
Goodman looked quite a bit like Chambers, and... was a real good fit for that. I've heard from people on Google. They say that one of his friends said that watching Goodman in the role was like seeing an old friend again.
Aw.
Yeah.
That's a compliment.
Yeah.
That's nice.
That is. Chambers was a legend, and boy, do we have some thoughts on his work on this one. We're not going to dispute his legendary status. So now, at long last, let's really get into the film itself, because again, we have things to say about it.
Rewatching the first 15 minutes of the film, this does have some good rewatch value, I must say, because you don't understand a lot of the things that they're doing, and then, you know, it all just seems like they are being intentionally mean, but...
You get it later.
Yeah, you get it. like after the second view, it's like, okay,
yeah,
I see what's going on here. And it's nice.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, we talked about the TV pedigree of the people making this film. That's not fair to the film. This is a very cinematic film.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's very colorful. Yeah, again, it's very cinematic. The camera work is great. The editing is wonderful.
It's very subtle. There's a lot of good, subtle techniques used in the film.
Yeah. The reveal of the, the nice pan-up reveal of the tribal camp as they ride into it is gorgeously done.
Yeah, this is definitely a theatrical film. This is, does not feel like a TV movie, even slightly.
No.
Yeah, but the film story is a really basic and very familiar one. The movie concerns a British aristocrat played by Harris, who is over in the States hunting. His party gets ambushed. He gets captured.
By the way, there is a parallel between how his party acts and how they treat him at the beginning of the film, how the Native Americans treat him.
Yeah, the Americans mock him just the same as the Sioux do. He is captured by members of the Sioux tribe. Right off the bat, I am going to give the film credit for using actual tribal names, and again, they tried to do their research. How accurate they were, I don't know, but I will give them credit. They did try. So, he gets captured, and they treat him as a
horse.
Yeah, and when he's captured, he's naked. And this movie, we see so much of Harris's ass.
Yes, we do. But none of his penis.
No. It wasn't an X-rated movie, but we do...
It's still the 70s here.
Well, you know, the 70s, but no, it's we do get, you know, but we do get lengthy shots. Harris, by the way, is in ridiculously good shape in this movie.
He is, yes.
He is definitely a man in the physical condition to run around as naked as he does.
Compliments to the makeup department on this film. Like, he sustains a lot of injuries in the film. Like, when he comes into camp, he's been dragged. Like, he tries to escape, and they drag him to camp.
Yeah.
And so for a good part of the first half, you know, you can see, like, you know, when he comes to camp, you can see his stomach is completely scratched up and bruised, and, you know, that kind of heals throughout the first half, and you can see, like, the progression of that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a nice little touch.
Again, the makeup department on this film was just top-notch. But yeah, as the film begins, he's treated like a workhorse. He's treated as a slave. Being the aristocrat that he is, and being kind of a conniver, he decides, okay, if I have to live among these people, I'm going to be the best that I can at them. I'm going to figure out how to succeed in this world.
Yeah, his initial plan is to is for escape after he meets Baptiste, mm-hmm. the other captive, who speaks French with a French accent, but he's not really French.
No, the actor was from Quebec, though.
Yeah. Well, there you go then. But yeah, the original plan is to rise the ranks, and then get a war party, and then be able to go from there. And actually escape back to England.
Yeah. And as the film goes on, he decides less and less to want to do that, and more to want to be a part of this world, because he genuinely falls in love with it. It follows his progression as he is humbled. By the end of the film, he goes from having been called horse because it's an insult, to bearing it as a name of honor. This is not a plot-heavy film. Let's call it what it is. This is not a plot-heavy film.
Yeah, it's a lot of subtlety. You know, the back half is more English heavy, but there's not very much, like, English in the film. It's mostly told through pantomime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we don't ever get subtitles on the Sioux.
No, never.
We never find out what they're saying.
We get translations from Baptiste, but that's it.
Yeah, and that's something that works really well in the early going. I kind of wish they'd gone on ahead, and as he started to understand it, gone on ahead and given us the translation.
That would have been cool.
I kind of would have liked to have known, just out of respect to these people. I would have liked to have known what they were saying. But yeah, most of the translations come from Baptiste, who is just a weasel. I mean, he is just a easily character.
He's there for 5 years, and he gets by acting like a fool. And, you know, he even says, you know, he doesn't... It's like, yeah, I don't... The fool doesn't work. The fool gets to stay alive, and all I have to do is dance a little.
Mm. He's a weasel. He's a slimy weasel of a character. And no, you enjoy watching him, but you don't particularly like him.
Yeah, this is true.
Because he doesn't grow. And that's actually something that at one point, Horse, for lack of a better name, calls him out on. At one point he says, you've lived with these people for 5 years. How have you not come to understand their ways?
Right. It's like, someone important dies and he's like, all right, you'll get to chief faster now. He's like, you idiot, somebody died.
Yeah, it's like, show some damned respect, which would have been nice. I mean, and it's interesting because it does show how much he comes to care about this world. He does come to care about these people. And I feel like that, if the plot that we're describing sounds familiar, we mentioned Dances with Wolves and Avatar earlier. We can't get past the fact that this movie pretty much is the wellspring from which those two films started. This movie, in terms of influencing Dances with Wolves, is so strong, I really kind of wonder if there wasn't potentially a lawsuit in this. I mean, obviously that there are tremendous differences in the plot, but the similarities are a little too similar.
Yeah, I haven't seen Dances with Wolves, but yeah, I have seen Avatar.
Yeah, Avatar totally lifts from this movie. I mean,
yeah.
Hard lifts from this movie. Again, movies I like, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, getting back to the translation thing, yeah, Batiste does do the translation, and you're never really quite sure how accurate some of his translations are, to be honest. I always kind of wondered about that.
Yeah, and it did kind of set up at one point in the film that, you know, maybe his translating was kind of devious, mm-hmm. like when they're about to do the sun ceremony.
Yeah.
Or he's trying to tell them why he should be inducted, you know, try to stay his case, and he said,
when you first brought me here, you said I was a horse, an animal, and to me, you were, all of you, mean, vicious, ignorant, superstitious, no. ugly,
no.
benighted savages.
No. No!
Repeat it. No. Repeat it!
Yeah, and then at first when he translates it, they're like, haha, yeah, yeah, you're still one of us, blah, blah, and Horace catches on to that and says, no, translate it right.
Yeah. He's willing to own up to his terribleness. If we're going to be talking about that scene, this is really a good moment to talk about how Harris is, in fact, in the film. The level of performance that he gives. Because I gotta say, he's really damn good in this movie.
Also, talk about the makeup effects on that section. Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
It's agonizing.
Yeah, the makeup effects on that section are a little too good.
Yeah.
There's a certain degree to which it's a little fake looking. I.e., the skin's a little too plasticky. But it's so intense and so well done, you really don't notice or care.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why I will never, just on the level that, kind of what he has to go through to, like, he has to go through a ceremony of pain, basically is what it is. He has to suffer.
And it is agonizing.
Oh, yeah. This is one of the reasons why I can never watch the film Hellraiser, because I know there's a lot of that in there, and I can't do that.
Well, we've already been through it once this year.
Yeah.
With American Mary.
That's true, but I'm pretty sure that film doesn't have quite as much as Hellraiser does.
No, it doesn't. And also, that film had the advantage of, bizarrely enough, I don't know why this makes it easier, but that film actually had people who were really and truly in that community.
That actually did make it a little easier. It did actually kind of put you a little at ease as you went in. And you got used to it.
So it was like, well, these people really do enjoy it. They really, this is their lifestyle.
That actually did help, yes.
By the way, the fact of how much the film used real body modders was confirmed for me on Twitter by one of the cast, so.
Nice. Yes.
So I gotta give...
I love the internet.
I love the internet. So yeah, we're dealing with this, and it's just fascinating to me. It just is, you know, so yeah, that whole sequence. Harris is giving this speech, and he just kills it. Because he conveys this anger and this rage and this sense of, okay, you tried to break me. Well, You didn't.
Like, I'm here, I'm alive, I still have all my spirit.
And it's almost a sense of, okay, I respect you because you were willing to hurt me that hard.
Right.
I love that. And Harris is just, again, he's transcendent in that sequence. He's on another level. He's really great in this movie. He gives a very physical performance, a very physically just demanding. There's not a lot of stunt doubles, if you will.
Yeah, I could tell that right off.
Obviously, the Sun Vow ceremony was a lot of prosthetics. It still didn't look like it was fun to shoot.
No.
The vow sequence, by the way, let's discuss what it entails.
Just to paint a picture.
Having claws, animal claws, dug into your chest, then hoisted up by your chest, and spun.
Ugh. Yeah, and he has a vision during that, which, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty sure at that level of pain, you just kind of shut down.
At that level of pain, you definitely start hallucinating, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe the sequence. And by the way, why is he trying to do all of this sequence? Why is he trying to become this member of the tribe at this point in time?
He needs to get married.
He wants to get married.
He can't do that unless he has his scars.
And so he's willing to go through all this pain just to get married. Yeah. I'm pausing on the married part because really he just wants to get laid.
Yeah, that did not escape me watching that. It's like, wow, men really do go through a lot to get laid, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, that's very much how it comes off in the movie. Because the woman that he's with, he does have a few brief conversations with, but not really many.
She also reveals it to him that she is a virgin, which in the movie means means that she can have any man she chooses,
mm-hmm.
except for him because he's not inducted yet.
Yeah, but he decides he can earn that place. And this is not a movie set in the present day. We just would like to remind people.
Yes.
Any values that you're hearing are reflective of a movie made 45 years ago, about a time even much earlier than that. I mean, the movie also goes through some of the other cliches that we expect. Like, if there is a character in these movies who is sporting facial hair, they will inevitably lose it as a sign that they have come to become one of these people.
Yeah.
And that's probably for the better, because that mustache was absolutely hysterical.
Yeah, I didn't even notice that he had one and lost it.
It was pretty hysterical. It was a big, thick, blonde mustache.
It's very British.
Oh, the styles in that day. And then, of course, there's the inevitable growing the hair, you know, becoming one of them. I mean, these physical transformation tropes. You saw that in Dances with Wolves. You saw that on an unbelievably massive scale in Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's a trope of the genre, is what it comes down to. But I'm giving the film the trope, so.
Yeah.
The film tries to depict the tribe well. As I said, let's see, there's the old woman we've got to talk about.
At the beginning of the film, you don't realize what's going on, but she has lost her husband?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's revealed later that, you know, when a woman loses all of her male family members, and she is basically shunned by the tribe and has to fend for herself.
Mm-hmm.
Unless she can take on a quote-unquote son.
And the minute the movie reveals that, it is the countdown clock is going until a horse takes on that role.
Oh, yeah.
We are just waiting for that moment to come. I mean, this is a film that is so subtle in some ways, and in other ways, it foreshadows everything pretty badly.
Yeah.
But that's just because we're aware of the tropes. I mean, and that's just a good rule of thumb. If you set up an idea like that in a film, you have to pay it off.
And it's frustrating when films don't pay stuff like that off.
Mm-hmm.
We watched a few recently that really haven't, including, you know, last week's film.
Yeah, last week's film was wall-to-wall stuff that just, again, I still, by the way, am convinced that movie was heavily re-edited. I
wouldn't doubt it.
I would love to know what was going on there, but yeah, you know, so she is, of course, very much, by the way, the cliché, she treats him badly, she bullies him, she whips him, but over time, of course, a bond comes to grow between them. Again, this is not a thread we haven't seen before, but it is very entertaining. Another trope that, of course, the movie deals with is the rival tribe.
Yeah, they play a pretty big part.
The Shoshone.
Yeah, the Shoshone. Yeah.
Again, another actual tribe.
And it's funny because that's the sequence where they first show up kind of mimics the sequence where the Sioux ambush horses camp, like with the bird calls.
Yeah, it's very well done. And it's very, it's very suspenseful and very intense.
Yeah, except, you know, the difference is that they are not caught completely unawares.
Yeah.
They're prepared for such an eventuality.
And we then get a good old-fashioned Western action sequence. We have to talk about the action sequences in this film, which were shot by the legendary Yakima Canutt, who, basically, if there was a Western action sequence that you're thinking of, he probably shot it. Stuntman, legend. Yeah, they're really...
Wow.
Yeah, really was a key figure in Westerns, and knew how to shoot good suspenseful action sequences. And it really pays off. It is a very suspenseful, well-cut set of sequences. You can really clearly follow what's going on. There's a nice visceral quality to them. I mean, these scenes still work 45 years later. I mean, they're still immensely entertaining. And, And, of course, it's in that first revenge sequence that... Horse earns his stripes, so to speak. He earns respect as he goes in. And by the way, credit due to the film, they don't all of a sudden establish him as someone who, like, he just happens to be okay at this kind of thing. They establish him as a hunter. They establish him as somebody for whom that's been what he's done for hobby for so long.
Yeah, that's what he's doing at the front of the foot, like, when... That's his introduction. He's hunting for birds. You know, he comments that, you know, he hunts for grouse back home, and he came, although he jumped continents just to hunt a different kind of bird.
Yeah. I mean, that's really what there really is a sense of this is a guy who needs to do more with his life, and he wants to do more.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is some sense of meaning when it does turn out that he gets that opportunity. And really, again, Harris just really sells that. He does a really great job of selling a man who is eager to take on this opportunity. Yeah, I really enjoyed those sequences. I really did. There is, sadly, a second sequence of ambush, and that one is really painful to watch. It's very graphic, too.
Mm, yeah.
Not every key character in the film makes it out alive.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, as much as... Are we doing full spoilers on this, or...
Let's go ahead and do full spoilers, because we have to.
Yeah, yeah. When Batiste dies, like, in that second ambush, even though it's weird, he's not a very likable character. Like, he's not, on a personal level, a very likable character. You do kind of go, oh no, when he dies. You know, for me, like, mostly it was, he was the link...
Yeah, he was the link.
Like, he was the language link.
But then again, maybe that's partially the dramatic idea that when he dies, it's no longer needed.
Maybe that's true, yes, in hindsight. But my first, like, reaction, not like, oh god, what a great character, why did he have to die? Because I think it was probably inevitable he was going to die, yeah. Honestly. But, you know, that was the first reaction, like, oh no, the language barrier.
Mm-hmm. Would that he were the most painful of these deaths.
Oh yeah, no. Yeah, in that same sequence, his pregnant wife dies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. That was hard.
Guys, this trope needs to die. I'm just gonna say it right now. I'm giving this film a pass because of the 45 years ago. We have got to stop killing women just so that men can be hurt. I hate this trope.
Yes.
Please stop.
Yes, please. It's women in fridges.
Mm-hmm.
Too. It's 40 years before that phrase was coined.
Yeah.
Yeah, and especially the pregnant woman. That's insult to injury.
I do kind of hate that the Shoshone are so faceless. I mean, mm-hmm. We get to know the Sioux pretty well, but the Shoshone are just faceless. They just sort of are there.
They're there. They're there to be the bad guy. They're there to be the enemy.
I kind of wish we hadn't gotten that. I kind of would have liked to know who these people were and what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a shame to me that the movie didn't give us more details. I would have liked more details. I really...
Yeah.
I mean, look, if Michael Bay can do a better job of personification of his enemies, then... you guys,
that's saying something.
But then again, that's kind of okay to me, because this is a movie about limited perspective.
It is. That's true.
So I can regret that from a modern standpoint, but it is a movie about limited perspective. They are the bad guy tribe. That's just who they are. We don't even get individual characters within them.
Yeah,
they are the tribe.
And, well, you know, the movie is also 6 minutes shy of 2 hours.
Yeah, this is also,
so
this is not... This movie would probably run 2.5 hours minimum today. But it's not. It's much more economical.
Yeah, for that runtime, it is a very economic film.
It is. I mean, we get a lot in, but I don't know. I mean, it's and you can't even say it's, well, different standards of the day. This is about the same time as Godfather, so, you know.
True.
You know. Epics were all the rage.
Yeah.
But then again, this is a smaller scale film. We have to talk about the locations, too. I mean, I really don't want to get off of that, because that's something that really impressed me about the film. This is a gorgeous looking film.
Wasn't it filmed in Quebec?
Let me see where it was filmed real quick.
I caught a glimpse of where it was filmed last night in the credits, but it didn't stick.
By the way, it is on Blu-ray, I should mention. It is, in fact, on Blu-ray.
Mm, that'd be a gorgeous one for Blu-ray.
It was filmed in South Dakota.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
It was filmed in South Dakota and Mexico. It was filmed in... I saw Custer National Park was one of the places listed that it was filmed. Okay, that's actually pretty much accurate. That's about the area it should be shot. The locations the movie used were just gorgeous. And it's interesting to me, because that made me think about how, over time, the standards of what makes for a great location haven't changed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a great sweeping vista is going to look the same across time. The mountainsides, the great plains looked gorgeous. Really great use of color on the film, too.
Yeah, it takes place at least over the course of a year. We do see some winter in there.
Yeah. And it's, although I will say, it was hilariously fake snow.
Yeah.
That was so obviously shredded paper, it was hysterical.
All to go back and look. How'd you say that?
It looked nothing like snow. I thought that was kind of hilarious. Just complaints. But again... The cinematography on the film was great. I don't think we give older films enough credit sometimes for just how great some of these shots can be. I mean,
I just watched Dr. Zhivago for the first time, and talk about a beautiful looking film.
Yeah, well, David Lean knew how to shoot stuff. You know, it's funny. I noticed Lawrence of Arabia is on Netflix and has gotten huge viewings.
Ooh. Is it like the full...
Restored version.
Ah, yes.
It's the restored version. Cool. You know, I think it's interesting that people are like, I have time to sit down and watch this 4-hour movie. Although they probably break it up. That's what I'm going to do. I've got a 4-hour documentary I need to watch for a future cast. But,
It's like, Lawrence Arabia is one of my favorite films. And it's just like, with those movies... It's almost like you're watching them and you just don't want them to end.
Yeah. This, again, I am struck by how great the location shooting was. This film really benefited immensely from the extensive location shooting. I don't know, probably good portions of it took place on sound stages, I'm sure, but it still looked good.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I just... Movies like this do strike a chord with me. The... big sky looks. I don't know. It's just something I do love.
It's a pretty grand film.
It is a grand film. I concede I don't have a lot to say about this film, you know, beyond these things, because it isn't a tremendously dense film. It's economical, but it's not dense with plot developments and convoluted plots. It is a story of a man adjusting to a culture and learning to become part of it. And I found that richly entertaining. It's a journey film. It is a movie. It's an experience film.
It is.
And I had a very good time watching it.
It's a film you kind of have to let wash over you.
Yeah, it really is. It is that. I mean, as I said, I definitely think it has its flaws. I mean, the characters definitely ring a lot thin to me. Horse and Batiste aside, the characters are pretty thin. I mean, this movie definitely has shallow love interest syndrome. And
oh, yeah, it does.
Really, very few of the characters beyond those two get much time and attention, but I really found it effective. It is an entertaining experience. I mean, especially if you're a genre historian, to look at this movie and be like, okay, this one really did have influence, even though it was probably a middle-of-the-road performer, and it was definitely produced in the churn. I definitely think it has had some staying power in the culture. It's just a good time. I had a very good time watching it.
Yeah, me too. There's some nice camera tricks in here.
Yeah.
There's some nice, like, it's one of those films. It's kind of nice.
I get kind of tired of people being afraid of the zoom shot.
Yeah, like, there's a thing, especially where, again, part of the quote-unquote experience of the film, where, you know, you see either side of the frame, two people chanting, and then in the middle is kind of a green screen-like thing, and it's very surreal and very beautiful to look at.
Yeah, there are some interesting techniques like that. Certainly, the whole Vow to the Sun thing was like, it was very cool. I mean, I'm going to invoke 2001 here, but it really reminded me of 2001 hardcore.
It did, yeah.
And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed being taken on this ride. I thought this was a really, it was an interesting experience, and it conveyed the feeling of pain really well.
Oh, God, yeah. Almost too well.
I kind of like that the film does have a certain meditative quality, that there are certain scenes that are just there to really create atmosphere. Like, I could imagine probably a version of this movie that's 20 minutes shorter and gets rid of some of those scenes, and I think that would have been a loss.
Yeah.
Because we're supposed to feel this transition. And I really liked that. I thought that was effective. Again, the guy that directed this, most of his work was television from what I saw. Was well directed. I definitely have to give them that. I also liked, by the way, the score was very subtle. That was something that really struck me. Like, I don't think there's any for the first 15 minutes, aside from the opening credits.
It's only really there when needed, and even then, most of it is diegetic.
Yeah. A lot of chants and songs and...
Yeah. And when it's non-diegetic, then you just don't even... Like, you don't, it just feels like part of the scenery.
Yeah, it just feels, and it feels like the music that, I think because we're so conditioned by films to think about
it. That's
true. We're so conditioned to think of, like, flute when we see a shot of a mountainside, we're conditioned to think of flute and a little bit of strings. Yeah. Seriously, try looking at a shot of like sweeping up into the sky as you see a bird flying over you and not think just a little bit of flute music in your head. It's just the sound that we expect. And I liked that touch, because I've seen some movies like this that just drown you in score.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't let you really pause to get the sense of atmosphere.
Which, hey, again, the counterpoint, Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, well, that was something Lean was known for. We do have to talk about the use of exposition in this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of limited.
It is. It's limited to Batiste's explanations for what's going on and translations, and that's about it.
The movie doesn't hit you over the head. It actually...
No, it doesn't.
This is a movie that I think would really frustrate people in the modern day, with the audiences who are like, get your phone up. You know, have your phone out and comment. I mean,
it's like it doesn't explain everything that's going on. It lets you infer some stuff. It lets you extrapolate from what you know.
And I think that's probably frustrating for certain viewers, because they're like, but I need to know everything.
Well, that's what cinema is supposed to do. Like, this is the job of cinema. I mean, television is a different medium. That's a whole different conversation, but
even television is getting away from that.
Yeah, it is. Like, television for a long time has been like akin to radio, to where you can kind of go off and do something else while watching it and not really look too much at the screen. But
yeah, No, this there really is very limited exposition on in this film, and I enjoyed that because it does force you to be an active viewer. You're not watching a play on screen, you're watching a movie. And some of the earlier Westerns, because of budgetary limitations, didn't get to be that way. So I really did enjoy that, yeah, this is a movie that felt like a movie and required you to put your phone down and pay attention. Obviously, I'm speaking in the modern sense. I don't think they had cell phones commonly in the 1970s or at all, but, you know.
Man, have you ever wondered what it would be like to, like, go back to 60s or 70s and try to say stuff like that to people that age? Put your phone... Why would you have your phone in a theater? What?
I know. Well, then don't talk during a movie, because that was something people always have done.
That's right. Oh, God.
I'm of the opinion, by the way, that you need to put your cell phone down. You need to, when you're watching a movie, when you're watching a movie, you're watching a movie.
I am so happy that big chain theaters are finally, like, putting, like, AMC put a thing in, I will make a shout out to my, one of my old college professors, Dr. Poe. Hey, Dr. Poe, if you're listening, he always used to preface films with, you know, don't use your phone. This is why. It's distracting. Like, your brain is trained to, you know, just zap onto any light it sees, and that will seriously distract from the film, and it's awful, so don't do it. And theater chains have started actually putting that explanation at the front of films. It's like, for love of God, thank you.
So again, it is interesting to me to watch a movie that is made for an audience that actually has to pay attention and doesn't have exposition shouted at them. I think it rewards them. Which is funny in light of the film that we're about to watch next, which will be much more exposition heavy.
Oh yeah, the next one, without giving too much away, is basically a play.
But, you know, again, I appreciated that. I know it seems strange to applaud a movie for feeling like a movie, but you watch enough of these and you really do come to appreciate it. I mean, Zapped Again was pretty talk heavy. It wasn't saying anything, but it was pretty talk heavy. It's funny to me that CBS produced this because this really did feel like a film. I mean, it was a movie. It was very successful. It was successful enough to lead, by the way, to two sequels. Return of a Man Called Horse, which Harris did come back for, and which, my understanding, reading the plot synopsis, sounds like a sequel. Or it doesn't sound like a sequel, it sounds like a remake.
Ah.
With Horse once again having been in England and brought back over to, and coming back over to the United States. Which, by the way, that automatically makes me go, well, something must have happened.
Yeah, that kind of undoes the end of this film.
Yeah, the end of this film is him riding off with his war party.
Like, I guess you could say that it leaves it open, but it really kind of doesn't.
No, he's made it pretty clear. He's happy here. He feels like he belongs.
Yeah.
And so then there's that story, which, by the way, that did have the same writer.
Hmm. Well, yeah.
It's still, and that still sounds to me, I have no interest in seeing, you know, another remake. But on the other hand, the second sequel is one of those wonderful sequels where Harris came back for about a few minutes, got his name above the title, and was killed off promptly.
Oh no.
And instead it follows his son.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I don't think I need to see that. And it was pretty soundly panned as a ripoff.
No.
As I did indeed enjoy this film, I don't feel the need to watch a sequel that's going to just take me back through the motions. I'm not interested.
Nah. No, this is one of those that works as a one-shot and doesn't really need it.
It doesn't need it. It's a good one-shot, but it is worth your time. I definitely...
Well, yeah.
Last week I did an ironic recommendation. No, this week, this one I'm actually giving a definite recommend to. Yeah, this one I actually really did enjoy. I might as well say it. It's on YouTube if you want to watch it.
Yeah.
I don't know how well it's on YouTube. It may be in poor quality, but I know it's at least there. But you know what? Don't watch it there. Go on ahead and try and find a decent copy of it.
Oh, yeah.
It's worth your time.
I got a DVD copy for the library, and...
As did I.
Watching it on a good stereo system is excellent.
Yeah, I watched it on my laptop, but it's still... It looks good. It plays well. It's worth your time. Again, a strong performance by Harris, some beautiful scenery, a familiar and, at this point, let's face it, kind of racist story. But you know what? One that I enjoyed. I give the film credit. I'm not holding it to modern standards. It's an entertaining film. Yeah, I think this is worth seeking out. Mom, thanks for the recommend. We hope you've enjoyed this.
Yeah, thank you.
I don't really know what else to say. I knew this was going to be kind of a lighter cast because the film is so sparse.
Yeah. And that's okay. I enjoyed it. It was a very good film. It was very fun to watch. You know, you do kind of have to turn off your PC sensibility for some of it.
Yeah.
But, well, that's what feminists have to do, so.
Yeah.
So it's nothing that new.
No, it's not. Treat it for what it is. Treat it for the historical artifact that it is. And it is an entertaining film. And so, yeah, I definitely recommend it. Next week, however... And by the way, I love the fact that we're now able to say next week.
Next week, and actually mean it.
Next week, as in next week.
It's October time.
It is October time, and we are indeed going... With the weekly cast, we're not going to be doing 4 Hitchcock movies. We don't want to drain the well and overdose that hard. We're not interested in doing that.
No, and God, you know, we have to put a lot into the Hitchcock cast, too, so it's...
We have to pay attention.
Yeah, we don't want to do that.
No, we want to do some really solid, interesting casts. And this year we're going to forego a couple of the ones that people might be thinking. We're going to go with a couple that are maybe not the ones that jump to people's minds. You know, we've been, you know, the last few years we have definitely been doing the Hitchcock films people think of. And God, I just want to pause and say I was thinking about Vertigo the other day, and man, that film does deserve its reputation. Yeah, Vertigo really is as great as people make it out to be. But you know, we were going to do The Birds, and a library fluke kept us from it. I'm kind of okay that we're not, because the film we're going to throw in its place is going to be pretty good. We're going to do Rope, will be our next episode. Hitchcock's real-time experiment.
Yes, and I haven't seen it in a while, but yeah, I remember some of the details he threw in there as far as the set goes. It's kind of amazing. Like, what he managed to pull off.
Get ready for some of the most analytical we've ever been. This one is rich with material. Rope awaits us next week. And then we're also going to cover The Trouble with Harry this month. For those who are curious what our other one's going to be. We're going to do that one. And then, filling the spaces, we've got Horror of 2 different variants awaiting us.
Yeah, we've got Best Night Ever.
We are going to get to that one.
Which I watched, I did sit down and watch the trailer for recently, and... Oh.
By the way, yeah. I just want to pause. You know that technically we could probably get away with not doing it. Nobody ever requested it of us, and the people that gave us the funding... It's true. We could get away with not doing it. I still want to do it.
We could, yeah, but, you know, we also promised we would, so...
We promised we would, and more to the point, I actually do want to look at Seltzerberg... outside of the parody genre. But we are going to be looking at Best Night Ever, and then we are going to... Damn it, No Totally just did this movie, and we're going to do it anyway. We are going to look at Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
Yeah, and in conjunction with Nightmare on Elm Street, because yeah, I've never seen it.
We're gonna really and truly give Wes Craven's his two entries into the series, the two that he directed, we're going to give those a look. Because, you know what? Freddy Krueger is awesome. Why not give him some looks?
Yeah.
So, that's what awaits y'all in the future.
October is going to be a fun month.
October is going to be a fun month. First of all, let's thank our patrons. Mom, obviously this one was for you.
Yes, thank you.
To Daisy, Sean from No Totally.
Sheila.
And Nathan. Hope you guys have enjoyed it. We really want to do more of these Patreon episodes, guys. Please.
Gonna say the same thing to Bridget that did to Nathan in the last cast, you know, in 3 months' time.
Can't wait to see what you do next.
Yeah, give us another suggestion. Keep them coming.
Guys, we have some real ambitious things coming this in the rest of the year, so yeah.
We do.
Let's see. Let's talk about where you can find us. First of all, you can find our Patreon at patreon.com/thefilmroom. And then I'm going to let you do the rest of the wrap-up.
All right. You can find us on the main blog at thefilmroom.podbean.com. We're on iTunes. You can subscribe to us there for your convenience. You can find us on Facebook. Like us there. Post on our wall. Facebook.com/thefilmworm. You can find us on our Twitters, which I forgot to mention last time, at filmwormcast. I am at ParanormanPRD. Austin is at Untitled User. I will also take this time to mention that we have an Easter egg Twitter. I'm not going to say what it is. I will just let you kind of discover it.
When you discover it, it's a hint to a future cast.
Yes, it is.
But we do have a secret. We do have a secret one that we really need to update soon.
We do need to. Yeah, we haven't posted on it for a while. That's a secret Easter egg for y'all to discover. So. And, yeah, we have a side blog. We're currently doing Nostalgia. The one that will come out in conjunction with this one is kind of a big one.
Uh-huh.
The filmroomlobby.wordpress.com.
Yep. In time, that's where we're hoping to, you know, put all of our operations, would be at a WordPress site. That's what our future goal is, and that's really what we're going to start working for.
Mm-hmm.
So, until next week, and until Hitchcocktober, I'm Austin Shin.
I'm Abba Roldsfong. Later, y'all.
Later.
In the dark, all the sweet green icing flows.